This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina has more than 15,000 untested rape kits, which is one of the highest reported backlogs in the country. And while there's been a lot of focus on this backlog and what police departments are doing about it, a new WFAE podcast is telling a story that goes behind the numbers. The podcast, She Says, follows one Charlotte rape survivor as she struggles to find justice.
On June 29th, 2015, a woman was sexually assaulted by a stranger in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's been nearly 3 years, and Linda, as we'll call her, is still waiting for answers, even though she believes she's known the truth the entire time.
I said, I know it's him. I mean, there's just no question there, period, in the story.
The situation is so unfortunate. Half of my career is in investigations, and I've never seen this situation happen before.
The She Says podcast takes listeners inside the investigation with interviews from law enforcement, nurses, judges, and attorneys. Joining me now to talk about it is Sarah D'Elia. She is arts and crime reporter for WFAE in Charlotte and host of the podcast She Says. Sarah, welcome to State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us how you found out about this story, a woman that we will call Linda for the course of this program and your podcast.
So Linda was sexually assaulted about 3 years ago in Charlotte, and she had a lot of questions about her investigation and where her case was really in the line of things. And she started a dialogue with my boss, the news director of WFAE, Greg Collard, and they kind of exchanged some messages back and forth between Twitter and eventually had a phone conversation. And she just kind of was curious about our coverage about sexual assault and the backlog that's here in Charlotte and across the state and across the country as well. And during that conversation, she eventually disclosed to him that she was a sexual assault survivor and had these questions about her own case. And so Greg kind of brought the story to the newsroom and said, you know, who's interested? Someone really needs to go and speak to this woman. And so I thought that it would be really important for a female journalist to kind of build that very close relationship that you have to have talking to someone that's gone through something like sexual assault. So I raised my hand and said, like, yeah, let's do it. And we just kind of started talking for her, and I've been speaking with her and following where she is in her case for about a year now. Yeah.
And you spend some time just talking with her without any kind of recording equipment just to get to know her and see whether or not she wanted to go through with this, right?
Right. Yeah. The first day I went to her house, it was just sort of I had my cell phone and my keys in my hand, and I was like, this is me. There's no recorder on me. I really just want to talk to you, hear your story, and, you know, give you an opportunity to ask me any questions about what this reporting process is going to be like. And then towards the end of the day, and it was the entire day I spent with her and her husband kind of talking to them about it, I said, you know, I don't want an answer right now. If you want to do this story, I want you to think about it because it's a really big decision and it has to be your decision completely. And then call me in a couple of days. So it was a long couple of days while we waited for her to call us back.
Eventually, she did tell you all of the details of the story. We have a clip of tape where she talks about what actually happened when she got in the car. But tell us the story that led up to this, the assault.
So Linda had been drinking, and she had some kind of argument with her husband that night, and she did what I think a lot of people do, is they need fresh air, and they go for a walk, and she was, you know, like I said, had been drinking and sort of was a little, knew she could go one way or she could go another way, and the other way that she chose to go was the path that wasn't towards the nicest neighborhood in Charlotte. But she went down that way, and she is introduced to a first man who kind of can tell that she's intoxicated, wants to help her out, wants to get her some water. And she discloses to him that she was going through some personal things. She also has PTSD from a previous abusive relationship, and she was very triggered that night. And she asked for drugs, and he introduced her to the man that she says gave her the drugs and then eventually assaulted her.
And here's what Linda says happened next.
I can't even explain really the feelings that I felt. I just kind of was numb. I just sat. And he started crying. And he said, why do I always do this? I didn't know what was going to happen next. I was afraid he was going to kill me. And I really thought that. And I kept thinking, my family's going to find me in a field in this shady place, you know, near uptown, and, you know, I'd be dead.
So when he started to cry, she had a thought. I can use this.
I said, we all do bad things, you know, nobody's perfect. And I said, you know, God forgives us of things, you know, let's just forget that this happened. I said, it's by this time it's past midnight, way past midnight and, you know, early into the morning hours. But it wasn't daylight yet. I remember tapping on the clock and I said, now my family they're going to be worried. My husband and my kids are going to be worried and they're going to be wondering where I'm at. So I said, if you would please just take me somewhere that, you know, I'm familiar with, and please drop me off there. And he looked me in the eyes, and he said, you know, you're a really good person.
That's a clip from the WFAE podcast, She Says. It's an 8-part series that follows a rape survivor who goes by the pseudonym Linda. I'm here with podcast host, WFAE arts and crime reporter, Sarah D'Elia. Now, that was 3 years ago, and of course, she was very active in trying to get justice for this right away. What did she do next?
So a couple of months go by. So she's assaulted in June 29th of 2015, and she feels like she's not getting a lot of response. And what I've heard from other detectives that I've interviewed is at first there's a lot of action, but then things sort of slow down. And Linda was kind of in that period where things were starting to slow down. And it's late September. It's right around the time of her anniversary with her husband. And she decides, since she's not getting a lot of answers, that she's going to try and figure out who this person was. That night, she says that he was wearing a shirt that had a patch that looked like it might be his last name. It had the company that she presumes that he works for, and he disclosed how old he was to her. So she goes online, and she's like, okay, well, I have these three key pieces of information. Let's see if I can find who he is. And she spends the entire night searching the internet, and she screenshots all of her searches, and eventually, she finds the face, the name of the person that she believes assaulted her.
It's an amazing moment for her, and she talked to you about it as part of the podcast. Here's how she describes it.
I was scrolling down. They're all thumbnails, no visible text of any, you know, names or anything. I'm seeing a lot of mugshots of all kinds of people. And I'm scrolling and I'm looking through at these thumbnails and I see his face. I clicked on that thumbnail, which had no name attached to it. The site came up. It was a mugshot. It had his first, middle, and the last name, which is a unique last name. Even regardless, I saw his face. I knew that was him right away, instantly. Clicked on it, then comes up, and then there's the, oh my gosh.
That's a clip from the WFAE podcast, She Says, an 8-part series that follows a rape survivor. Pseudonym is Linda. I'm here with the podcast host, WFAE arts and crime reporter, Sarah D'Elia. So now she believes she's found the man. What does she do next?
So she takes all those screenshots and she first calls the detective and says, is this something that you even want to look at? I mean, I don't even know what to do with the information that I have. The detective says, you know, yeah, send whatever you have over. And so she kind of makes it into a PDF file and sends it to the detective and then has to follow up with the detective to make sure that she did get it because she didn't hear back from her right away. And then not a lot happens. There's a period of time that goes, the detective is out on some personal leave and Linda is kind of just left waiting and wondering where is her case in the line of things and does this internet search actually mean anything?
Let's go back a little bit to talk about just that question, because this becomes increasingly important to Linda as she's wondering where this investigation is and how quickly things are moving along. I mean, we've talked and reported, and as you have, I know, the number of untested rape kits in this state of North Carolina. Has her rape test been tested? A rape kit been tested? Do you know?
It has been, yes. And but there was a lot of questions with her of when it was and how it was tested and what was found. And the way that it works in Charlotte, since we have our own crime lab, if your assault happens in Charlotte, you're going to be dealing with CMPD's crime lab. It's a little bit different. But her kit was processed, and she eventually does get some DNA results. But the police have said that it took much longer than they would have liked it to have taken because of the backlog that we're experiencing.
Well, this is interesting, though. They've got DNA, now evidence. It's been tested. She thinks she has found the man who did this. Is there any way the police can put this together?
Well, I don't want to give too much of the podcast away, but I will say that, you know, the internet search, the police have said that it is a key piece of information. And I just really hope that people will listen to the podcast and hopefully kind of put these pieces together while she does and the police do at the same time.
Because it's so much of this really centers on how the investigation takes place. And again, very early on in this process, Linda talks about how she felt things were being handled. And here we have a tape of her describing the interview process when she talks with detectives about what happened to her.
People had asked me if I'd been in a car accident. So I was black and blue all over my neck. I was hoarse because I couldn't talk. I had a bruise in the shape of a handprint on the inner left thigh. So I got very upset, like not angry with her, but just like hurt that she was asking me these questions like this. And I pointed from like my head to my toes and I said, "Does this look like consent to you?" I was just shocked. I thought, you know, I thought these people would be trained on this. The first thing you do, and now I especially know, is you believe someone when they tell you this.
That's a clip from the WFAE podcast. She says Linda talking about her interview with police detectives after she reported her rape to them. And the podcast now follows her journey into figuring out how she can find justice for this. What is she telling you? What is Linda feeling about all this in terms of the way she's being treated?
I mean, I think she's very frustrated. And I think that clip that you just played where she goes over how she felt the interaction was kind of from day one with the detectives working her case. I mean, she looked like she had been beaten up. And we have checked out her medical records and seen a lot of the doctor's notes and stuff from that night. And she felt like she was still had to like keep proving over and over and over again that something had happened to her and that it wasn't consensual. I mean, and that's just extremely frustrating for a sexual assault survivor. And that leads to not feeling very heard by the person that's supposed to be helping you put your case together, like this detective. So, I mean, I know that she feels very frustrated and it's just kind of like banging your head against the wall of, you know, doing the brave thing, coming forward, sharing, you know, what happened to you, and then feeling like you have to keep making your case over and over and over again.
And to what extent, because historically this has been the problem in getting justice done in these cases. She's got some of these markers that we've seen all too often used against the victim. Alcohol is involved. She acknowledges that drugs were involved in this, that she was at some point in this process seeking drugs. So all of these things that, you know, make the victim themselves sound like there's something wrong with them. This is what we've been dealing with and part of the problem that we've been trying to sort out in all of this. How much is she aware of that these are the things that are precisely what interferes with the proper investigation of these kinds of cases?
She's very aware of it. And she's, to her credit, I mean, she's very honest. She told me everything that she told the police. And to, you know, go to the police and say I was seeking drugs, I mean, that's a big thing. That's not something that she hid from them, which I think speaks a lot to her story. But it is one of those things. What I love about this story is I think it makes people challenge the way that we think about, like, quote unquote, the perfect victim. There is no such thing as the quote-unquote perfect victim because, you know, yes, she made some choices. She wished that she could go back and redo. But at the end of the day, it doesn't justify an assault, and it doesn't justify the way that she's spoken to in some cases. And further down in the podcast, we actually compare her story to another sexual assault survivor. And in that case, she was assaulted while she was asleep in her own home. And she was asked some questions by the police that we get into of if they should have actually been asked in the first place. So I think that it really, this podcast pushes people to think about like the own inherent judgments that we find ourselves having every day.
Well, and it's certainly important for us to challenge all of those and decide if we're deciding who is a worthy victim and who isn't, we need to challenge all of that. What are the police saying about that? Because professionally, they need to be trained not to consider that.
Right. So they have told us that, you know, that was not a factor in Linda's case. and that, you know, they treated her case just as they would any other case, and that it got the same, you know, attention as any other kind of case would. That's what they've told us.
Talk about the taking on this project yourself as a podcast, you know, this just gentle balance between getting at the truth, publicizing this, and at the same time not further victimizing the survivor. How did you handle all of that? How are you handling that?
Yeah, it's a lot to juggle. And we do have a lot of collective conversations in the newsroom about what we're doing and if it's the right way to do it. And there are a lot of, you know, opinions that we kind of weigh and discuss, but it is a lot. I mean, and the thing is, you know, I've listened to a lot of podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and it's really easy when it's a good one and you get enveloped in the story and you forget that this is someone's life and that they're still dealing with it in real time. So I try to be as sensitive to that as I possibly can. And I still speak to Linda, you know, several times a week because we're still making the episodes too. And her case is still ongoing as well. So it's definitely a balance, and it's something that I take really seriously, and knowing that, you know, whatever we're doing could have an impact on her life. I mean, that's something that we talk and think a lot about all the time.
So there's the way in which you approach her as a human being who is also the subject of your story, and then there's this kind of more objective view of these kinds of stories. I mean, I'm thinking about that Rolling Stone article as an example of what can go wrong when you take on a story like this and you don't know how it's all going to come out, and you really don't know how it all happened.
Right. Yeah. It's a lot of pressure for sure. We've done our best to do background checks and look at medical records and police reports and court documents. I mean, we've been at the courthouse more hours than I'd like to admit. So, you know, we're trying our best to do our due diligence and triple fact checked everything that we possibly can.
What kind of listener response have you gotten? I know you launched just last month, but what sort of response have you gotten so far?
It's been pretty positive so far, which is nice. There are some people that have, you know, questioned Linda and the drug seeking of that night. But I think that it's kind of an opportunity when that question comes up to have a conversation and to say, well, why do you think that? And what are the judgments that are there? And kind of working through that. So mostly it's been very positive. A lot of people have a lot of questions. And if police did certain things, if they didn't do certain things, I get a lot of voicemails at my desk asking me if we've thought of X, Y, or Z. So it's nice that people are so interested in her story. And another thing that we do is each week we do ask our listeners to participate in the podcast. So we have a question in our mid-break of the podcast, and we ask our listeners, you know, if you're a sexual assault survivor, what was your experience with this? And we have a voicemail. People call. They leave their thoughts, their stories, and we play back those voicemails at the end of the episode and make them available online as well. So it really is trying to include as many voices because we know that sexual assault looks different for every single person, and there are parts of Linda's story that are really going to resonate with people. And then there are some people that are going to say, that wasn't my experience at all. So, you know, we're trying to include as many people as we possibly can.
Can you give us an idea of some of the responses you've gotten to the particular questions that you've asked?
There was one that really stuck with me. They all do, and we listen to all of them, I should say. But this one in particular, there was a woman who called that said that she was in the military and she was raped by someone, a colleague of hers. And when he left after the assault was done, as he was walking out the door, he said, you know, like, you can try to report this, but who's going to believe you? It was something along those lines. And it was just very chilling to, you know, and that assault, she said, happened in the last few years. So it was just very chilling to think that that's something that happens. We know that it's something that happens frequently.
Sarah D'Elia, an arts and crime reporter for WFAE in Charlotte, host of the investigative podcast She Says. Sarah, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You can find links to the episodes and a new episode of She Says. A new one drops every Thursday at midnight. We've got links to the ones that are already posted at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we learn about an audiovisual project inspired by Wilmington. It's called From the River to the Ocean, and we'll talk about it next on The State of Things.